The reading is found on page 1058, Luke chapter 22, verse 47 to 62. While he was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" When Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, "Lord, should we strike with our swords?" And one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. But Jesus answered, "No more of this," and he touched the man's ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns." Then, seizing him, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance, and when some there had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, "This man was with him." But he denied it. "Woman, I don't know him," he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, "You are also one of them." "Man, I am not," Peter replied. About an hour later, another asserted, "Certainly, this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean." Peter replied, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." Just as he was speaking, the cock crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him. "Before the cock crows today, you will disown me three times." And he went outside and wept bitterly.
Thanks, Kristen. Do keep your finger there in Luke 22, because we'll be looking down it as we go. But let me start by asking a seemingly obvious question. Who recognises this guy? Anyone know who he is? Bill Clinton, absolutely. The 42nd president of the United States, the third youngest president, a huge advocate for social welfare, presided over the longest peacetime economic expansion in American history. In fact, he has the highest end of office ratings of any president since World War II. He's generally considered a pretty good president. But I wonder what it is that springs to mind when you think of Bill Clinton. Anyone want to share what they think? The giggling suggests the same thing. His affair. The allegations of an affair. Probably the most famous thing he said was, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. These allegations are false. Clinton held the most important and powerful office in the world. He had a reputation and a public persona to uphold. And if these things were true, the things he was being accused of, then it could end his career. It could be the end of his reputation and would result in legal repercussions. And of course, it did turn out to be true. He had improper relations with the woman. He denied the accusations in an attempt to protect himself and all that he held dear, his job, his power, his marriage, his image. He couldn't go back and undo what he'd done, but he could try to hide it to stay safe. Now, we may not have a desk in the Oval Office, but our stakes are lower and the feeling is something we know, wanting to protect ourselves. Maybe our denials are less public and we have a shorter distance to fall, but we can probably all think of a time when we've been nervous for something to come to light in fear of the consequences. Well, that's something we start to see in our passage today. And we're starting a new series in the Gospel of Luke. And Luke was a book written to a friend. He's named in chapter 1 as Theophilus. And it's important to see why Luke wrote to him. Luke says it's a carefully investigated, orderly account of Jesus' life so that Theophilus may know for certain that these things happened, that he can be sure of these events. And that's why we still look at it today, so that we can be certain that these things happened. And we're picking up at the end of Jesus' ministry, the end of the book, as Jesus is preparing to head to the cross. And this passage that we've just read, it's a dark passage. We don't get any sense of joy or happiness. Someone snuck some sad stuff into the Bible. It's a book featuring violence, injustice, and misuses of power, bookended by betrayal and weeping, by a stab in the back from a friend, and bitter weeping from denial. And in this passage, we have two distinct sections, which we'll look at quite closely, and then we'll think about what they mean for us. So part one, the arrest, starting at verse 47. Here we are on the Mount of Olives, where Jesus has just been praying in anguish. He's been sweating drops like blood. And then he comes back to find his disciples asleep. He wakes them up and rebukes them. That's what's happened just before this passage. And as he's speaking, over the hill comes a mob. And it's not how we may picture a mob, an unruly, disorderly gang, maybe with flames and pitchforks on a witch hunt, but rather a very dignified mob, a crowd of all hierarchy of the Jewish leadership, the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, the elders, and their servants. And they're wielding swords and clubs and leading the way. Look at verse 47. Judas. And Luke makes a big point of this. Judas, one of the 12. One of Jesus' hand-selected, chosen followers. One of his inner circle, one of his closest friends, is leading the charge against him. And even worse, Judas goes to greet Jesus affectionately. He doesn't just point him out and say, "There he is." No, he goes to greet him with a kiss, a sign of love. But he's trying so hard to cover his betrayal. Jesus sees right through it. Verse 48, "Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? You can't hide your betrayal from me." But notice, Jesus doesn't run or fight, even though he knows exactly what's happening. No, Jesus stays put. And the disciples, they see what's happening, and they start to panic. "Should we strike with our swords?" they ask, verse 49. You can feel the tension here. It's like that moment before a protest turns into a riot. You've seen the photos, a policeman standing opposite a protester, each side waiting for the other to make a false move, a flailing baton or a careless projectile. And once that boundary's crossed, chaos, violence, anarchy. And that's the same tension we feel here. One side set out to arrest, the other side set out to defend. And sure enough, someone does break that deadlock. And it's the disciples, verse 50. One of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. But instead of that chaos and that anarchy that we expect, Jesus steps in. "No more of this," he says, verse 51. But he then even takes it a step further, undoing the damage that his disciples have caused and healing the servant's ear. He doesn't just stop what is about to happen, he reverses what just has. He takes a moment in the middle of his arrest to show compassion towards an enemy in a miraculous way, which makes everything that follows so much more surprising. Under any other circumstances, we'd be stunned and in awe. Ears don't just grow back. But here, we don't get any indication that anyone even responds. They're focused on arresting Jesus. They're defiant and blinded to the truth of who he is. And Jesus similarly doesn't use this as a way of trying to invalidate the arrest. He doesn't say, "Hey, I just healed an ear, guys. I'm obviously the Son of God." No, he never tries to stop them arresting him. But he does question how they go about it. Look down at verses 52 and 53. Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts and you did not lay a hand on me." Jesus highlights the injustice of his arrest. If they had real reason to arrest him, couldn't they have done it in the daytime rather than the cover of night? But we're told earlier in Luke that these Jewish authorities are scared of the people. So they've used underhand tactics to get a friend to betray Jesus so they can arrest him without causing a scene. And the amazing thing is, Jesus lets it happen. He submits to it. "This is your hour," he says, verse 53, "when darkness reigns." Jesus isn't fighting. For this moment, he'll let darkness prevail. As one author puts it, darkness must fall before a new day can come. Do we see the contrast in this passage? A human drama of emotions, betrayal leading to shame, fear, panic and aggression, as the disciples and the Jewish authorities try to seize control of the situation. They're all focused on the immediate problem of either arresting Jesus or protecting him. They don't see a bigger picture. But Jesus does. Jesus has already told us that this will happen. He first predicts his death in chapter 9, verse 22. He says, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and he must be killed." Elders, chief priests, teachers of the law, the same people who are here on the Mount of Olives arresting him. Jesus knows. The second time he predicts his death, chapter 9, verse 44, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men." He'll be arrested. Jesus knows. The third time Jesus predicts his death, everything that is written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled. He'll be delivered over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, insult him, and spit on him. They will flog him and kill him. Jesus knows that everything happening right now in this passage is to fulfill God's plan. Just before verse 47, Jesus had been out in the Garden of Gethsemane praying, "Not my will, but yours be done." He knows what he's going to have to endure, but he understands it's in God's control. And so knowing that, how does he respond? He calmly stops the violence. He graciously heals his enemy. He gently submits to darkness's reign. He knows what needs to happen. He knows he's going to have to suffer. He knows it's unjust. And Jesus could just stop it all. But he allows it to happen because he knows God, his Father, is in control. And Jesus is going to follow his plan through. The disciples, they're caught up in the here and now, which seems understandable. From their perspective, what good is a crucified Messiah? How can he redeem God's people if he's nailed to a cross or laid in a tomb to rot? They can't see the bigger picture. They're not certain of what's happening or why. The true importance of it hasn't been revealed to them yet. The glorious good news is that it has been for us. We know the rest of the story and we know what happens next. Jesus dies for the forgiveness of sins and then rises again, defeating death. We can be certain and confident in that, but still all too often we get caught up in what's happening around us, something we've been thinking about in Ecclesiastes, instead of looking to Jesus. And we get an idea of what that can look like for us as we look at Peter. So let's pick up the story again at verse 54. Jesus is seized. "Then seizing him, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest, whilst Peter follows at a safe distance. He then comes into the courtyard of the house where some of those who are arresting Jesus have made a fire, and Peter sits down with them." These are not friends. It wouldn't be a nice warm environment like this. These are very much the opposite. Peter's behind enemy lines, and we get the impression from Luke that he's the only one of Jesus' followers that hasn't disappeared into the night. It seems like a brave and loyal act. Something courageous. But then the accusations come, three of them building with intensity. And similarly, the denials escalate too. Peter, in fear for his life, panicked by his surroundings, asserts intensely that he does not know Jesus, that he's not one of his followers. They have no idea what they're even talking about. Let's have a look at the denials and accusations. Look down at verse 56 and we'll just read through them again. "A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, 'This man was with him.' But he denied it. 'Woman, I don't know him,' he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, 'You are also one of them.' 'Man, I am not,' Peter replied. About an hour later, another asserted, 'Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean.' Peter replied, 'Man, I don't know what you're talking about.' Just as he was speaking, the cock crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him, 'Before the cock crows today, you'll disown me three times.' And he went outside and wept bitterly." Put yourselves in Peter's shoes here. You're in the courtyard. Somewhere in the house next to you is Jesus facing an unknown fate, and you were unable to stop it. And you were an accomplice of his. You helped him in his work. The arresting party are sat all around you, and in the flicker of the firelight, the servant girl is looking at you, and she points, "This man was with him." It's not a question, it's not private, it's an announcement. She's telling the people around her, "This man, don't you see? Look closely." Who can blame Peter for wanting to save himself? It'd be a really scary situation, and we'd probably all do the same. It's survival instinct. He knows that if he's exposed, it could easily mean death. And when Peter faces the accusation twice more, his guard's already raised, and as the accusations come, they move straight from one to another, despite the difference in time, allowing for that intensity to build, like a tennis match back and forth until we feel the heat of that final denial, "I don't know what you're talking about." And as he's speaking, the cock crows and Jesus looks. Three actions happening at the same time. Peter's denying, the cock's crowing, and Jesus is turning. It's the climax of this dramatic sequence, and we feel the climb in intensity to this point, and then we feel the drop as Peter realizes what's happened. He's denied Jesus, just as Jesus said, and this crushes Peter. Verse 62, he went outside and wept bitterly. We probably know that feeling, don't we? When we've messed up and let someone else down and there's nothing we can do. When we promise we'll do something for someone and it just slips our mind. Or we break something with someone else's irreparably. And we can't undo the damage. Or maybe when we get that text saying, "Hey, I'm here, where are you?" And we realize we'd made plans that we've forgotten. The painful realization that you've messed up, that you've let someone down and maybe even hurt someone. That sinking feeling in your stomach when it's too late to go back. Maybe you can think of times when you've felt similarly. That helps us kind of get an understanding of where Peter might be at. He can't take back those things he said. He can't go back to the fire and say, "Actually, I do know Jesus, I was just kidding." It's too late. He's let Jesus down and Jesus knows it. And worse, Peter knows that Jesus knows it. He can't hide. Jesus even already knew it before Peter did. And that's probably why it's particularly crushing to Peter. Look across with me, just back a little bit to verse 31. And just read from verse 31. Peter and Jesus are talking, and Jesus says to Peter, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat, but I've prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you've turned back, strengthen your brothers." But he, that's Peter, replied, "Look, Lord, I'm ready to go with you to prison and to death." Jesus answered, "I tell you, Peter, before the cock crows today, you'll deny three times that you know me." There's the prediction of Peter's denial, but what preceded it? Peter claiming that he'll follow Jesus to prison or to death. It's confident words from Peter, confidence in his faith in Jesus. It was Peter who proclaimed Jesus the Messiah earlier in chapter 9 of Luke. And here he says he'll go to death for him. Well, we see in chapter 22 that the truth is far from that. At the first sign of trouble, Peter retreats. His confident words stand broken and unfulfilled. When push came to shove, he turned away from what he'd said, and in doing so, turned away from his Lord Jesus. In his desperation not to be ostracized, persecuted, or punished, Peter forgot the one who was most important to him. And it's a huge fall from this confidence in Christ to an adamance that he doesn't know him. No wonder he was crushed when Jesus looked at him. He was reminded of his utter failure. And I think it's easy to be confused by Peter. How can someone so confident in Jesus, who hung out with him for 3 years and saw all the miracles he did, deny so adamantly? But I think we forget how easy it is to make claims when we feel confident, claims that we can never live up to. "Yeah, I can get that piece of work done before the end of the week. No, that's not too much food. I can eat it all." Or maybe even that we'll get an early night tonight. Day to day, we make claims that we fail to live up to, and that includes in our faith. We're no different to Peter. And we could leave it there on a sour note where the passage ends, but that's not the end of the story. There is hope, even for someone like Peter. You see, whilst Peter's words didn't hold, Jesus's did. So we've seen Jesus' arrest, Peter's denial, and then we look at our response. Look back again at verse 31, what Jesus says to Peter at the end of that verse, "And when you've turned back, strengthen your brothers." Jesus knows Peter's going to turn away. He predicts his denial a moment later. And then that's exactly what happens. Jesus knows what's coming next. So we can be certain that the rest of what he says here will be fulfilled too. Peter will turn back and he'll strengthen his brothers. And sure enough, if we were to turn forward a couple of chapters to chapter 24, when the women see the empty tomb and come and tell the disciples, none of them believe it, except one, Peter, who runs to the tomb to see it for himself. And if we then skipped a bit further on into Luke's second book, the book of Acts, we'd see how Peter starts to lead the early church, how he speaks at Pentecost, and how he brings 3,000 new believers to faith in Jesus in doing so. Jesus told Peter that this would happen, and even though Peter fell from grace quite dramatically, he's restored after the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus kept his word to Peter, and even though Peter denied him and left him, Jesus never left Peter. In fact, Jesus loved Peter so much that he went to the cross for him so that he can be forgiven. That's how willing he is to forgive Peter for his denials. He's ready to die for him. And maybe we can see similarities with ourselves and Peter. We've talked about it a little bit already. Maybe we know that we deny Jesus or are nervous of speaking up in our faith in fear of being ostracized, persecuted, or punished, just like Peter was. That could be at work when someone says to us, "What did you get up to this weekend?" We make a conscious effort to avoid saying anything about church because we don't want to seem weird. Or it could be with family and friends who share different beliefs to us. So we just decide we're not going to talk about faith at all because we don't want to get into a heated discussion. Maybe it's less about fear of judgment and actually you recognize Peter's confidence in faith, but you also know how it feels to not live up to that. Every Sunday we sing songs about God's greatness, our awe of him. We've just sung, "Behold our God." But by Monday, do we feel the same need to encourage others to come and adore him? Do we feel it in ourselves? In some way or another, we all deny Jesus. But Jesus didn't just come to restore an ear to a servant. He came to restore us to him, to restore anyone who trusts in him. He didn't just go to the cross for Peter because he loved Peter. He went to the cross for you and me and everyone because he loved everyone. And maybe if you're here and you don't, would say you don't know Jesus, well then have a look at this story and be encouraged by the fact that Jesus died for everyone. He didn't just come for Peter and for his followers. He came for everyone, including the servant whose ear was struck off. He's gracious toward anyone who wants to know him. And we all deny Jesus. But as you think about the things you may do to deny Jesus, also remember it's exactly those things that Jesus went to the cross for. He didn't go for all the good things we do. He went for when we mess up. And it's possible here today that you're thinking, "Nope, God could never forgive me. I'm too far gone. He could never forgive that." Well, can I encourage you to look at Peter? Peter, one of Jesus' most intimate friends, crumbled completely under the pressure when he wasn't fully reliant on God. It happens. But Jesus is there to forgive all of us who turn to him. No ifs, ands, or buts. So even though this passage is dark, there is good news to come. So what can we do? What does it mean for us? How can we stop ourselves getting caught in these cycles of denial? Well, we're still fallen people. We still stray into temptation, and we probably still will deny. But maybe we can set ourselves some simple reminders of what we can be certain of to help us. Firstly, and most obviously, we can start by praying. To open up the relationship with God. We've probably all experienced a friendship that's faded out due to a lack of communication until it's just no longer visible in our lives. You wouldn't know that we know that person. Well, that's what it's like when we don't talk to God. The more we talk to him, the more we engage with him, the more present we'll find him in our lives and in our consciousness. And similarly, if we read his word, the same thing will happen. Daily devotionals are a great place to start, so do be encouraging each other. Sharing methods of reading God's word. But maybe it's simply just a case of being more intentional with putting God up front in our conversations. So that when we're asked what we got up to at the weekend, we're expecting to talk about church and why we go. Or maybe it could be as simple as taking home a service sheet today and putting it up somewhere that you can see so you're reminded of the words you sang and they can be reminders throughout the week. Jesus died for us. We get caught up in our surroundings and we deny him, fearing the consequences of being forward in our faith, and often feeling like we've done too much wrong to be forgiven. but it's exactly for those reasons that Jesus died. And that should be an encouragement for all of us to live for him and him first and put him first and not hide him away in our lives. Let me pray for us.